Tonight on the Space Show, we are going to be looking at the Apollo 17 mission, and it's the first of three programs in which we look at the last Apollo to fly to the moon, and not the last Apollo, I might add, but the last Apollo to fly to the moon. And we're going to have three programs dedicated to this and looking at alternative histories, what might have happened there. So tonight's program, we're going to be joined soon by Harrison Smith at a talk he gave in Frankston describing his flight to the moon. But just a little bit of backstory. Manned spaceflight in America began with the Mercury flights. These were one-man craft, and there were six manned flights. Two of them were suborbital, and four of them were orbital, and they took place between 1961 and 1963. They were followed by the Gemini two-man spacecraft. There were 10 of these manned flights. And then we began the Apollo. They began with a number of suborbital flights, and then there were 10 orbital unmanned flights. And then the manned flights began, these three people aboard Apollo. And the first of these was Apollo 7 in 1968 October. It went into Earth orbit. Apollo 8 followed in 1968 December and went into lunar orbit and did 10 orbits around the moon. Then Apollo 9 in 1969 March did an Earth orbital flight, and that checked out the lunar module. And Apollo 10 then went to the moon in 1969 May and went into orbit around the moon, and the astronauts flew the lunar module down to fairly close to the lunar surface but didn't touch down. There was no intention to do so. And then Apollo 11 was the first attempt to land. In 1969 July, a lunar landing was made, and the astronauts stayed on the moon for 21 hours and 36 minutes. That was followed in November of 1969 by Apollo 12, and again another lunar landing, and they stayed on the moon there for 31 hours and 31 minutes. And then came Apollo 13. This again was intended to be a lunar landing in 1970 April, but problems happened on the way to the moon, so it became a cislunar flight. That is, they went around the moon and then came headed back towards Earth, making a successful landing. Then Apollo 14 followed in 1971 January with a repair, a modified Apollo capsule to fix up the problems in Apollo 13, and that was another lunar landing mission. And they carried a modular equipment transport, a little golf, like those little buggies that golfers use to haul their golf clubs in. And they stayed on the moon for 33 hours and 30 minutes. Apollo 15 followed in 1971 July, another lunar landing, this time carrying the Lunar Roving Vehicle, the LRV, a little electric vehicle. And they stayed on the moon for 66 hours and 54 minutes. Apollo 16 followed in 1972 April, a lunar landing mission, again carrying a lunar roving vehicle, and they stayed for 71 hours and 14 minutes. And then came Apollo 17 in 1972 December, 40 years ago this week. That was a lunar landing, carried their lunar roving vehicle, and they stayed on the moon for 74 hours and 59 minutes. Well, the story of Apollo 17, of course, begins way back in 1961 with the announcement by President Kennedy that he would ask Congress to approve an American trip to the moon, and Congress did that. And the particular Saturn V vehicle, it's AS-512, Apollo Saturn number 512, rocket assembly took 16 months, starting in 1967 July, for that particular vehicle. It was the last manned Saturn V. There was one more Saturn V flight. There was a Skylab in 1973. This particular vehicle, AS-512 for Apollo 17, rolled out of the pad, and which was, by the way, pad 39A, and that rolled out 1972 June the 28th. And during that journey out to the pad, which is about a 5 kilometre trip, it sometimes reached the breakneck speed of wait for it, 1 kilometre per hour. Well, for the Apollo 17 launch, there were 3,503 press representatives accredited. That's more than for the Apollo 11 mission. 700,000 people gathered to watch the night launch, and that launch was at 12:33 a.m. American Eastern Standard Time on Thursday, 1972, December the 7th. And because it was a night launch, it was seen from up to 800 kilometres away and heard for quite some distance around the launch area. It first entered Earth orbit of a height of around about 169 kilometres, made two orbits of the Earth, and then did what's called a translunar insertion, in which the Saturn IV-B rocket fired for 5 minutes and 51 seconds, blasting them on the path towards the Moon. With the crew on this flight were Gene Cernan, a commander, Harrison Smith, the lunar module pilot, and Ronald Evans, the command module pilot. The total flight duration from liftoff until return to Earth was 301 hours and 52 minutes. When they landed on the Moon, they did three extra vehicular activities, that's moonwalks, and they totaled 23 hours and 10 minutes. Then on the way back, Ronald Evans did a spacewalk to recover some film from the service module of the command and service module. They did that about midway between the Earth and the Moon, and that lasted 1 hour and 6 minutes. While on the Moon, the two astronauts, which by the way were Gene Cernan and Harrison Smith, they drove 35 kilometres with the lunar roving vehicle. They brought back 110 kilograms of lunar samples. Meanwhile, the command and service module was in orbit around the Moon, and it did a total of 75 revolutions around the Moon. And they splashed down in the Pacific Ocean on 1972, December the 19th. Well, soon we're going to be hearing from Harrison Smith, a talk he gave here in Melbourne. More about that later. But let's just put you in the picture here with a little bit from a NASA documentary about Apollo 17.
December 6, 1972. Eugene Cernan, veteran astronaut and commander of Apollo 17. He would be the last Apollo astronaut to stand on the surface of the Moon. Dr. Harrison Schmitt, better known as Jack. He would be the first geologist to set foot on an alien world. Ronald Evans, command module pilot. He would remain in lunar orbit, operating a battery of experiments that would take this last close look at the Moon. In the year 1675, Sir Isaac Newton was asked by his fellow scientist, Robert Hooke, how he had accomplished so much. "If I have seen further," Newton wrote, "it is by standing on the shoulders of giants."
One command, pressurized, the S4B stage, was not given. And despite the fact that it was going to be done manually, the sequencer, in effect, said, I didn't tell you to do it, and therefore you can't be doing it. So at 30 seconds, it very properly stopped the operation. So most of the work was being done right off the firing room in the Launch Control Center at Kennedy. However, there was a great deal of support from the Marshall Space Flight Center, who had a comparable operational group working there with their contractors. So we concluded that we were safe, and we gave the word to jump out to 1 second and proceed, which we did.
go for orbit. Go for orbit.
Those are kind words, Robert. We're go for orbit here.
After checking out the spacecraft in Earth orbit, they burned out of orbit and headed toward the moon.
Houston, we're right in the middle of a snowstorm.
Ron Evans, at the controls of the Command Module America, moved in to dock with the Lunar Module Challenger. They pulled Challenger free of the booster's third stage, then continued the three-day coast to the moon.
Our topic on this evening's The Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM is Apollo 17. Yes, it's 40 years since the last lunar landing. Well, we'll now sort of get ourselves into lunar orbit and see how the mission went from there.
December 10, 1972. America and Challenger went into orbit around the moon.
Houston, this is America. You can breathe easier. America has arrived on station for the Challenger head.
The next day, December 11th, Cernan and Schmidt entered the lunar module and undocked.
You look just as pretty in Earth light as you do in sunlight.
In the distance, they passed over their landing place, a valley in an area of the moon called Taurus Littro. Here they hoped to find the youngest material yet sampled and direct evidence of lunar volcanoes.
You're looking real good, Gene. Right down the line.
Now, okay, stand by for pitch over. Oh, are we coming in? Proceed in. And there it is, Houston. There's Camelot. Wild wow. Target. I see it. We got them all. 42 degrees, 37 degrees, to 5,500. 53 degrees. Okay, I've got Barre, I've got Poppy, I've got the triangle. That's 2,500 feet, 52 degrees. H-dot is good. 2,000. H-dot is good. Fuel is good. One down at 10. Cut the H-dot. Fuel's good. 110 feet. Stand by for some dust. A little forward, G. Inward forward a little. 90 feet. A little forward velocity. 80 feet. Going down at 3.
Challenger, that's super.
Houston, you can tell America that Challenger is a Taurus Littro.
And that was the landing on the moon, the final manned landing for the Apollo program. And we're going to now, or in a moment, head off to Frankston, where one of those astronauts gave a talk. But first, we better tell you who we are.
Reaching into your community, the great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Yes, the Harrison Smith, the only scientist to travel to the moon, was in Melbourne for a talk to the Nepean group of Rotary International. And this talk took place at the Mornington Racecourse. And we are going to hear an introduction to him by Bruce Bilson of the Nepean Rotary International. And then we'll hear what Harrison Smith had to say.
We have with us, as I was saying, a remarkable individual, an individual born in New Mexico, United States. He's had at least four successful careers as a geologist, an astronaut, a congressman, a senator, and also as a very successful businessman. Harrison Schmidt holds a Bachelor of Science and a Doctorate of Philosophy in Geology. He's the last man and the only scientist to walk on the moon on the 12th of December 1972, and later a geologist in a Senate full of lawyers. Two very courageous acts to you, Harrison. He was handpicked by NASA in 1965 for Apollo 18 mission, and because of congressional cuts to the NASA budget, was brought forward to participate in Apollo 17. Amongst connoisseurs of the Apollo history, some would argue Apollo 17 was the most successful Apollo mission. Probably not the one that earned as much media coverage as others, but probably the most workmanlike utility for space exploration and understanding the lunar surface and the moon, with Harrison and his team bringing back more than 200 kilograms of samples and items to study from the moon. He was quite a different gentleman, as I said, a scientist and a geologist with no flying experience prior to being selected by NASA. In the biography within the program for this evening, it talks about his 53-week course to gain his Air Force jet wings and later his Navy helicopter wings. He worked with NASA scientists in developing scoops, shovels and other equipment to be used on moon expeditions. His single space flight was aboard Apollo 17 lunar landing mission in 1972. This was Apollo's last manned mission to the moon. He was accompanied on the mission by Commander Eugene Cernan, Command Module Pilot Ronald Evans. During their 3 days on the lunar surface, Harrison set up scientific experiments and drove to the nearby mountains in their lunar roving vehicle, collecting rock and soil samples. Mission controllers operated a television camera mounted on the driver, documenting Harrison's detailed description of craters, boulders, and the soil they found in the Taurus-Littrow Valley. They returned to Earth with a record 249 pounds of lunar material. He's been described as a driven man with an honest desire to be involved in the significant things that influence the future. He was the first man, and you have my respect here, Harrison, unquestionably, to oust an incumbent New Mexico senator. They don't change their senators very much in New Mexico, and they tend not to change them towards Republican senators. So that's quite an achievement in public life, Harrison. He campaigned across New Mexico on a red pickup truck for 6 years as the Republican senator. Democrats mockingly asked the voters, "What on earth has Harrison Schmidt done for you?" They stopped laughing when the newcomer beat the incumbent, the late Joseph Montoya, with 57% of the vote. He emerged as one of the most powerful legislators in the US Congress, not only on space issues, but also in the whole field of science policy. He's a truly remarkable individual. We're blessed and honoured to have you here tonight. Please welcome Harrison Schmidt.
And that was Bruce Bilson from the Nepean Group of Rotary International. And he was speaking at the Mornington Racecourse. And now we hear from Harrison Smith himself.
And we'll begin to take a trip to the moon. I think we have to turn the machine on there. And we're going to begin that trip with a sort of summary slide that illustrates the beginning of an Apollo mission to the moon, in this particular case, the Apollo 17 mission. The Saturn V rocket and the spacecraft, which were up here in this section, was truly a remarkable achievement technologically and from a human point of view. The first thing I want to remind you of, those of you that are familiar with the movie Apollo 13, is that in that movie you might have gotten the impression that the people of Apollo, particularly those in mission control and the engineers and others who were working Apollo so diligently, were in their late 30s and early 40s. In actual fact, they were in their 20s. They were just out of engineering school in various places in the United States, and indeed, actually throughout the world. There were a significant number of Australians and others who came to the United States in response to the challenge that President John Kennedy gave us in 1961 to go to the moon and return safely to Earth. And that program was not only internationalized by that a small migration of engineers and skilled workers, but also by the sample analysis program and many other activities that were truly made into international efforts. The Saturn V rocket, however, is still the largest rocket ever to be used to take human beings into space. It weighed 6.8 million pounds, fully fueled, about 364 feet high. It had thrust in the five big engines here of 7.5 million pounds when they were ignited and at full thrust. This building in which it was assembled at the time and for many decades afterwards was the largest contained space constructed by man on Earth. It has since been eclipsed, I'm sorry to say, by a mall in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And not to be satisfied with that, they're enlarging it. But this vehicle assembly building is fully utilized today. That's where all the space shuttles are assembled prior to their flight. We had a great deal of different types of training, most of it in computer-driven simulators that mimicked in very, very profound ways and very useful ways our spacecraft. But we also, by the time Apollo 13 literally was training for their flight to the moon, we had a training program in science that used up about 3 or 4 or 5 days a month. The whole program was aimed at making as good field geologists out of these test pilots that we had inherited. We, the scientists like myself, had inherited because of the original test and political nature of Apollo. Making as good field geologists out of them as we possibly could. And indeed, even though I was the only scientist to go to the moon, the astronauts from Neil Armstrong on all did an outstanding job in gathering the samples, in taking the photography, and indeed often making very, very profound observations that ultimately led to a first-order understanding of this small planet. Here you see Gene Cernan and myself out near Flagstaff, Arizona, in a simulated exercise using a working model of the lunar roving vehicle. Why Gene felt he had to wear these checkered pants on trips like this, I have no idea. These Navy test pilots, if you've ever known one, are of a different breed. We also had something called survival training. And by the way, those of you over here to the left can't see these pictures, either because I'm in the way or because you're too far to the left. So don't hesitate to get up if you feel uncomfortable. Move to the back of the room or someplace to see it. If there's some kids and some young people in the audience who'd like to come up closer, we already have a few up here. Don't hesitate to come up as well. They really are pretty nice pictures. But in this case, you see some very young and somewhat skeptical-looking astronauts learning about the care, feeding, and preparation of boa constrictor. Each of the astronauts in that picture ultimately went to the moon. Vance Brand, who's on the left, he and I trained for Apollo 15 together, but he ended up being a commander on several space shuttle flights. The boa constrictor, as you probably know, many of you, I'm sure, have experienced some of the exotic animals of the world, and they all are reputed to taste like chicken. Boa constrictor actually does taste like chicken, although albeit very stringy chicken. The launch of Apollo 17 took place on December 7th, 1972, the 30-year anniversary this December. At this point in the mission, about 12 to 14 seconds into the launch, The actual G-loading or acceleration is very minimal, but the extremely heavy vibration at this, because of the interaction of the plumes of the five first-stage engines. That vibration is similar, and I was using this expression up until about 24 hours ago, is similar to driving your Land Rover or other four-wheel drive vehicle down a railroad track on the ties. Well, I'm told that ties don't mean anything in Australia. I have to call them sleepers. Now you know what I'm talking about, right? I didn't know what I was talking about, obviously. It really is a very, very heavy vibration. At 2 minutes and 45 seconds, the acceleration reaches 4 times gravity. We shut off this first stage rocket. We actually decelerate a little bit at 1.5 times gravity. And then the second stage rocket kicks in, and we're going again at about 1.5 times gravity, positive Gs. All of that change happens in just over a second. That gets your attention. You know why you're wearing seat belts and shoulder harnesses, believe me. But in 10 minutes, we're in orbit around the Earth. I'm not going to take you on an orbital trip of the Earth. I think probably some of you have had that already from some of the Australian astronauts who have been in space using the space shuttle. I'll keep trying to improve the focus of these pictures. It seems to want to hold out a little bit. This picture actually was taken over the eastern South Pacific on one of our two orbits of the Earth. But I do want you to look up there at that band of blue in the upper left-hand corner of the picture. It is our atmosphere looking directly through it. And I'll call it to your attention a little bit later when we get to the moon. Once we were had accelerated from our orbital velocity of 18,000 miles an hour to a velocity of 25,000 miles an hour, so that we would actually be able to get out of the Earth's influence, gravitational influence, and into that of the moon, we undocked from the rocket, or detached ourselves would be a better term, moved away from the end of the third stage rocket, turned around, and came back in to retrieve the lunar module, which you see there tucked away in the end of that rocket. I also want to draw your attention to those bright spots around the rocket. They are pieces of ice that formed on the rocket while it was sitting on the launch pad in Florida, a very humid climate, and with the very, very cold liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen tanks on this rocket as well as the others, a great deal of frost formed on the Saturn V. Most of that came off during that heavy vibration phase that I mentioned previously, but some of it obviously stayed with us as we went on our trajectory to the moon. Some of you may recall that when John Glenn went over Australia, back in the Mercury days, the earliest American space program, he reported seeing what he thought might be fireflies in orbit with him. I suspect John was seeing his own little cloud of ice that he was traveling with in orbit. But then again, he and I served in the Senate together, representing different parties. He does come from the other party, and seeing fireflies might be explainable by that. This picture of a nearly full Earth is one that I took from about 34,000 miles away. Looking back, you can see that at the bottom of the picture, the Antarctic and South Pole, all of the continent of Africa is visible. Up in the upper right portion of the picture is a spiral pattern that is a typhoon or hurricane going ashore in India. And as you can see, we really do have a very, very good observation platform when you're on your way to the moon. It took us 3.5 days to get to the moon, and about 24 hours after this picture was taken, I was able to take this one, which will look a little more familiar to you. you got it. That's your home continent of Australia right there. But why is it covered with clouds? This is December when this picture was taken. And actually, those clouds disappeared very fast the next day, and we had an excellent view of Australia all the way to the moon. If you know your geography, these spots right here are the Philippines, islands, and right there is a very, very tightly, intensely organized typhoon that was known as Teresa. And you already know that some years later, I married a woman named Teresa, and there may have been some premonition in watching this typhoon sit in the Philippine Sea for about 3 days as we went to the moon. Additionally, there's a typhoon being organized here near Guam, which nobody knew about, and so we did contribute a little bit to the weather forecasting of the Pacific by identifying that particular body. Once we had reached the vicinity of the moon, our first task was, of course, to go into orbit. And you, here you see, I apologize, these are just not quite sharpening up like I would like them to, but that's the best apparently you can do. The maybe a little hand focusing over there would help. But here you see the mountains of the moon crossing the Earth, now at a somewhat smaller phase. And that is what we called LOS, loss of signal, because for the next 45 minutes, there was no radio communication with the Earth on each of the two-hour orbits around the moon. And that actually was pretty nice. Houston can often ask you to do things you'd just rather not do. And so we, let me see what happened here. I guess that, as long as nothing was going wrong, we were very, very happy for that silence. Landing in the Valley of Taurus Electro was reasonably straightforward for us. We had, the benefit of the experience from many other, several other missions. Our landing point was going to be right there where that red dot is between those two craters. If you look carefully, there's a that is the other spacecraft. Ron Evans is all alone in that spacecraft now, as he would be for the next approximately 75 hours. In this particular case, he's below us, a little bit ahead of us, and he's taking some final navigational sightings on the landing area, which ultimately we used, was fed into our computer after being processed on the Earth, fed into our computer, and then the next orbit of the moon, we began our descent into the Valley of Taurus Littoral. Well, this picture actually got out of sequence, and I apologize that for a little bit. This is a sunrise on the far side of the moon, and the reason I was going to show it, and am showing it, is to draw your attention that there is no band of blue around the moon. The moon's gravity is only 1/6 that of the Earth. That means many different things. One is that these young people here would only weigh 1/6 their weight if they were on the moon, which isn't very much. And, of course, any of you, if you were on the moon, would only weigh 1/6 of what you weigh here. But it also means there's no atmosphere being held to the moon. The vacuum at the surface of the moon is essentially that of deep space. Really a very, very hard vacuum. And as a result, there's none of the oxidation that we're used to here on Earth as a result of oxygen. So the desert of the moon, which literally we're looking at, an extraordinarily dry desert, no water at all, is not as colorful as we're used to here on Earth. Now back to the surface of the moon. This picture is the first picture that I took as I looked out of the spacecraft after landing. Gives you, a very good feeling for the nature of the surface that we had landed on, and indeed several of the other missions had landed on similar types of surfaces in other parts of the moon. It's a covering of pulverized rock, overlying lavas that we call basalts here on Earth, and I actually think I've seen some similar types of rocks in some road cuts as we drove around Melbourne the last few hours. In this case, however, these rocks have absolutely no water in them, which is unusual for the Earth. In fact, you always find some water in Earth rocks. And in the case of this particular landing site, the rocks are full of the element titanium as well, much more so than normal. The base of this mountain here is about 4 to 5 kilometers away. You're going to have to take my word for that because there are just no houses or telephone poles by which you could judge the distance any better than we could when we were there. Judging distance in this kind of a situation is very difficult, and so you're very dependent on the measurements that you make from your maps and photographs. The metallic-looking object in the foreground is one of 16 small rockets we had around the spacecraft that allowed us to control the orientation of our spacecraft while we were actually in flight. Now this, you want to just move that a little bit so they can see the lunar module a little better instead of the grating? There you go. That's great. This is our home. This was our home. I just want to be sure you saw it while we were on the moon. It was a great camp. Geologists always think of their home as a camp, and I'm sure my wife thinks that's what I think our home is sometimes. But in this case, it was very comfortable. 1/6 gravity is a great environment in which to sleep. Just enough weight so you feel like you're sleeping on something, but not enough that you would want to toss and turn at all. The food was reasonably good, freeze-dried, dehydrated food that we just added water to and were able to eat quite easily. And maybe most importantly for geologists, and maybe for some of you, there are no black flies up there to bother. By the way, that debris layer that's on top of the rock averages about 9 meters deep on the moon. And I guess I should apologize for giving you a whole bunch of different units here, but we build our rockets using the English system of measure. We flew them using a nautical system of measure, and we worked on the moon using a metric system of measure. And how we got through the whole Apollo program without getting all that confused, I don't know. But we did, and maybe we were just paying more attention than those who had a recent Mars flight get confused because of the transfer of units. The this picture you have to look at, largely because I like to look at it, but it also, I think, demonstrates that desert-like quality of the moon. In this case, there are large blocks of this lava, basalt, around a crater that actually lies off to the left. It's about 600 meters in diameter. And there in the middle ground is the lunar roving vehicle. This antenna here is pointed directly back to the Earth and at the time was transmitting television pictures of our activities in this boulder field.
On the space show this evening, we are at the Nepean Group of Rotary International at the Mornington Racecourse. And our speaker is Harrison Schmidt, the last person to step onto the moon in the Apollo program that happened 40 years ago. Right, we return now to Harrison Schmidt and the Nepean Group of Rotary International.
This picture illustrates several things. One, it illustrates your home, only 400,000 kilometers away. Being homesick really didn't present a problem, but communications were so good that might explain some of that, and we were also extremely busy. The other thing I want to point out to you that I should have pointed out earlier with some of the pictures of the Earth is that when you're actually in space, when you see the Earth, it's against an absolute black background. In this background, there's still some color. There's still some light coming through. Even the pictures that you see printed, the background is not an absolute black, unlike space, and so we had a much better contrast of what we saw with respect to the Earth, as well as much better detail while we were in space. And so if you want to see that kind of view, you're just going to have to go into space, because so far we haven't been able to bring back a photograph that does it justice. Now, some friends of mine and I are trying to get the original film that we used in space digitized. And so it may be that in a year or two, we will have truly representative pictures of rather than just some of these multi-generation photographs that you see now. Gene Cernan is seen here testing out the lunar roving vehicle. It was a very fine four-wheel drive field vehicle for us. Each wheel had an independent electric motor, independent suspension. We had front and rear wheel steering if we needed it. And could drive about 10 or 12 kilometers an hour over this surface. Now, that may not sound like very much, but remember, we're driving in 1/6 gravity. So anytime you hit a bump, you're going to be off the surface for a while. And you just have to be very careful about that. Make sure you're not rotating at the same time that you hit a bump. We took this up to about 18 kilometers an hour downhill once and regretted it. It was a little bit too fast. Getting on the lunar rover was reasonably straightforward. Here you see me having been standing at the side of the rover, jumping up into the vacuum with a little bit of leftward translation and hoping that I'm going to come down in the seat assigned to me. We learned how to operate in 1/6 gravity pretty fast. And it really everything worked fairly well, fairly efficiently, in spite of the stiff suit and other problems. This is a television camera that was used to send pictures back to Earth. It was operated remotely from the Earth. We didn't fool with it very much. Some experimental gear out here on the back. The post for the antenna. This is called an Omni antenna. That was what we used while we were driving. It allowed us to communicate during that time, but not to send television pictures back. One of the problems we had with commanders during these missions was that they seemed to like to break fenders off of lunar rovers. And here you see that had happened to us, but also you can see that with the help of some of my friends on Earth, we figured out how to repair it, and that was by taping together some unneeded photo maps with gray duct tape. You all know what duct tape is, right?
Yeah.
Figured that. It's probably holding this building together, as a matter of fact. It certainly was holding a fender together on the moon. Needless to say, we became honorary members of most automotive repair organizations in the United States. The reason we had to have this was that these particles of dust and rock in the debris layer on the moon would actually adhere to this wheel, this wire wheel, long enough to give you a forward rooster tail, or driving into your own dust would have become routine. That just was not really acceptable. You didn't want to get that dirty, even though we ended up getting quite dirty anyway. This is what a well-dressed astronaut wears on the moon before, and certainly cleaner than I was when we ended the excursion. This was actually on our first excursion. The weight of the suit, my weight inside it, and the backpack all totaled about 370 Earth pounds. But on the moon, that's only about 61 pounds. So you can maybe understand why we seem to be having such a great time when we're up there. It's a lot easier than training. And I found that at that weight and with the mobility, the even limited mobility I had in the legs and the hip of this suit, that I could run across the surface like a cross-country skier would run, gliding above the surface, and get speeds routinely of about 6 kilometers an hour, and probably without too much trouble, if I had needed to in an emergency, could have sustained about 10 kilometers an hour for some extended period of time. The suit is obviously not a perfect set of clothes.